Today's Takeaway podcast is an extended version of what we normally give you on this podcast version of the Takeaway. It's a full version of our radio program plus some extras. We hope you enjoy it. Russia's strongman security under Putin suddenly looks dubious.
People who before thought that they could quietly sit in their kitchens and simply just discuss problems within the family, now they would start reconsidering everything what's going on in our country.
The assassination death of a member of the political opposition and some Russians say enough. I'm John Hockenberry, and this is The Takeaway. Also, the new politics in Russia this hour, some old politics in Washington, D.C., and we can't get enough of live band Red Barat. A South Asian sound by way of South Brooklyn live all this hour. Take that, B.J. Lederman. Also, a somber homecoming story from World War II, 70 years old. Share what you know at 877-8MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening on this cold, cold Monday. It's cold around the United States, and the question is, has the violent death on the streets near the Kremlin in Russia on Friday of Russian opposition leader Boris Nemtsov pushed some Russians to the limit? That's the sound of tens of thousands of Russians rallying in the very cold rain, chanting, "Russia without Putin. We will not forget. We will not forgive." Former Prime Minister Mikhail Kazyanov, speaking to the rally, is urging the Russian people into action.
People who before thought that they could quietly sit in their kitchens and simply just discuss problems within the family, now they would start reconsidering everything what's going on in our country.
The question, of course, is will this change anything in terms of Vladimir Putin's popularity or his ironclad grip on the state apparatus? Joining me in the studio, Masha Gessen. She's a Russian-American journalist, author of the forthcoming book about the Boston Marathon bombings, The Brothers, The Road to an American Tragedy. Masha, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Is it complacency that we would use to describe the Russian people in terms of their relative hesitancy to take action? Or is Putin really popular? What does this do to the equation?
It's neither. And I think, you know, using those words to describe Russia is actually rather misleading because you're talking about Russia as though Russia were a normal democratic society and people were just complacent and sort of or supporting whatever is going on. Russia is well on its way to becoming a fully totalitarian state. From having been an authoritarian state, a structure that was built by Putin over the first 12 years of his rule, over the last 3 years, it has been becoming a totalitarian state. He's been putting into motion the mechanisms of totalitarianism that were never really destroyed after the Soviet Union collapsed. So you can't really use words like popularity with any sort of meaning when you're talking about Russia, as Hannah Arendt wrote when she wrote about totalitarianism. The problem with the totalitarian system is not that it forces beliefs onto people, it's that it robs them of the very ability to form beliefs. You know, it is a matter of survival in a totalitarian state to know which way the wind is blowing and to go with the wind. Because, again, I want to say it's a matter of survival. So people will sincerely give the kind of answers that they're expected to give because it's a matter of survival. That's what accounts for the 84% popularity numbers that we get for Putin.
Do you think Boris Nemtsov believed that his end was in the cards somewhere, that this would be the way that he would die?
Yes and no. I mean, he was getting threats constantly for years. And that's the trick, right? If you're getting death threats constantly for years, on the one hand, you can't help but take them seriously. You realize it only takes one person to carry out the threat. On the other hand, you can't live your life in fear and sort of you become... this is where the word complacent may be a little bit more appropriate. You grow used to it. So I've been told, I actually have no personal experience with this, but I've been told that he had the habit of turning off his phone for the night because he was getting so many threatening phone calls in the middle of the night.
What do you make of these protests? Because each one of these events, fighting in Ukraine, annexation of the Crimea, and now the death of Nemtsov are tests of this fear factor on the part of the populace in Russia. And it seems as though he's going to pass the test. These rallies are not terribly significant.
you're right. They're not terribly significant. I mean, it is a almost a heroic act on the part of every one of those tens of thousands of people who came out into the streets in Moscow. And the estimates range from about 50,000 to about 100,000. That's a lot of people in the street. It's not a lot of people for a city of about 12 million. So each one of those people is very, very brave. And part of the reason that each one of them is very, very brave is because each one of those people knows that going out into the street carries great risks and no benefits whatsoever. It's not like any of the levers that exist in a normal society for turning a street protest into action exist anymore. So it's a purely symbolic act. It takes a lot of courage to commit that act, but there are never going to be that many people who do that.
So a rally can't become a political challenge in the way that seemed possible even 6 or 7 years ago.
Exactly. I would even say it seemed possible 3 years ago. That's the most significant change we've seen in the last 3 years since Putin cracked down in response to the mass protests of 2011-2012.
So is Putin doing this to keep his job, to keep the jobs of his pals around him? Or do we see tanks in Riga and Tallinn in the Baltics at some point?
Oh, those are not contradictory propositions.
Really?
He is doing it to keep power. To keep power, he needs to continue mobilizing the population. He needs ever more popular and ever more aggressive campaigns in order to mobilize the population, especially in the face of a failing economy. And I think, yeah, the Baltics are very much in danger because Putin wants to keep power.
Do you think the Ukraine situation is a stalemate and it will stay like this in the indefinite future? Or will there be some sort of territorial consolidation? There will become some sort of eastern Ukraine zone, or that Ukraine will fall on some level?
I don't really want to make predictions about Ukraine because I don't have any more of an understanding of it than Putin has a plan for it. He doesn't have a plan. What he does understand,
he's improvising,
and he understands very clearly that he needs to keep mobilizing. He needs to keep the fervor going. How he's going to do that exactly from day to day and from month to month, he doesn't know, and we don't know.
Mm. And I guess as we watch the people in the streets, it only underscores just how heroic their act is. Then, in the face of all of what you said.
Absolutely. I mean, and I have the greatest of respect for each one of those people. I'm afraid that when Kasyanov says, you know, this is going to change everything and people are going to act, that's wishful thinking. That's unfortunately not happening.
Masha Gessen is a Russian-American journalist, author of the forthcoming book about the Boston Marathon bombings, The Brothers, The Road to an American Tragedy. Masha, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
This is The Takeaway. There they are, live in our very crowded studio. Actually, we've got two studios going, one for me and one for our live band, Red Barat, playing just for us. We love big ideas on The Takeaway, you know that, and we love their big idea music. We'll be hearing them all hour long. Thanks, guys. Stay with us. Joining us now is Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. And Todd, once upon a time, there was bipartisan agreement about U.S. policy regarding Iran, but that may be over forever when Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu addresses Congress this week.
My speech is not intended to show any disrespect to President Obama or the esteemed office that he holds. I have great respect for both. My speech is also not intended to inject Israel into the American partisan debate. An important reason why our alliance has grown stronger is that it has been championed by both parties, and so it must remain.
Well, it might be a little late for that. Netanyahu has injected himself into the American partisan debate, speaking there at the AIPAC Israel Lobby Policy Conference in Washington today. Todd, can Benjamin Netanyahu backpedal here? He's already in the middle of this debate.
He really is. And the political parts of this, Netanyahu versus Obama or Boehner versus Obama, have been injected into this a long time ago, despite the efforts of a lot of different members of Congress and even some administration officials lately to try and defuse that, John. But it's not going away. That's Netanyahu's speech today at AIPAC, and tomorrow in front of the U.S. Congress, the controversial invitation from Speaker John Boehner, which really upended protocol, of course. It wasn't the fact that Netanyahu was speaking to an American audience or even to a joint session of Congress. That would have been easy. Everyone knows how popular Israel is among U.S. congresspersons of both parties. It was really the fact that John Boehner, the speaker, went around the State Department, went around Obama, and invited Netanyahu 2 weeks before his election to speak directly to Congress without consulting the White House. That was a shock to the State Department and a shock to the White House. But John, the speaker was on the Sunday shows just this weekend defending his choice.
The threat coming from Iran and the Iranians having a nuclear weapon is a threat to the region, it's a threat to the United States, and it's a threat to the rest of the world. This is a serious issue. And we're not going to resolve this issue by sticking our heads in the sand. The Prime Minister can talk about this threat, I believe, better than anyone. And the United States Congress wants to hear from him, and so do the American people.
Todd, it's widely reported in Israel that Netanyahu wants to kill this deal, the negotiations over the Iran nuclear program with the U.S., Iran, and other nations. Do you think he believes that he can do it?
Yeah, he's not alone. I don't know what he believes necessarily, but John, he has pretty good indications now to think that there are a lot of members of Congress on both sides of the aisle behind him. Look, the frustration and anger over the invitation notwithstanding, there are a lot of movements within Congress to try and kill this deal before it's even born or shortly thereafter. Most notably, Senator Bob Corker, he's chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, and he's out with a new bill. There have been a lot of these floating around, but he's got a new one that's signed on to by a lot of Democrats, John. It would essentially give Congress control over the details of this deal. It would require President Obama to submit any nuclear deal with Iran and the P5+1 to Congress for review and an up and down vote. And in the meantime, would prevent, and this is crucial, would prevent the president from tinkering with any of the sanctions against Iran. Now, that's crucial because Iran is desperate to get out from under economic sanctions. That's why they're at the negotiating table right now. And ratcheting back on some sanctions, dialing them back, is one of the key tools that the White House has to get Iran to comply with the details of any deal. And then in the long term, of course, it would take Congress to repeal any sanctions if Iran proved to be faithful to any deal. This bill from Corker is saying, no, Congress wants control over this. The president is guaranteed to veto that message. So Netanyahu can be sure he has a lot of allies in Congress.
Bottom line for Netanyahu, this is his deal, speaking before AIPAC.
Israel and the United States agree that Iran should not have nuclear weapons, but we disagree on the best way to prevent Iran from developing those weapons. American leaders worry about the security of their country. Israeli leaders worry about the survival of their country.
And reassurance came from U.S. officials, White House officials, including Samantha Power, the ambassador to the United Nations, also speaking at AIPAC today.
The United States of America will not allow Iran to obtain a nuclear weapon, period.
Was that tepid applause, Todd? What do you think?
I think a lot of people in that crowd don't buy it. They don't buy that message. But the White House is trying not to cede the entire public stage to Netanyahu and his high-profile speech tomorrow. Today at AIPAC, you heard from Samantha Power there, the UN ambassador, Susan Rice, the national security advisor, who said that Netanyahu's speech is destructive to the U.S.-Israel relationship, speaks tonight, and President Obama himself granting an interview to Reuters to give his message on the White House deal in advance of Netanyahu's speech tomorrow, John.
Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
You got it.
Eerily, quietly, all around the Earth, scientists are taking steps to prepare the human race to leave this lovely, warm, cold, snowy, wet, dry, cloudy, blue planet. In the past decade, astronomers using the Kepler space-based telescope have solidly established the existence of possible candidates for planets, some even within the range of the conditions we experience here on Earth. It's a journey of a lifetime that would take a lifetime, but the time has come in human civilization to concretely anticipate the science of such a journey. And this week on The Takeaway, we are leaving Earth with the help of Natalie Battaglia, the Kepler mission scientist and astronomer at the NASA Ames Research Center. Our first stop is exoplanet Kepler 438b.
At first glance, this appears to be a planet very much like Earth. It's about the same size, only about 10% larger than Earth in its radius. It receives about the same amount of energy from its star that Earth receives from its sun. And so you might think that it's going to be very much Earth-like, but as we travel there and take a closer look, we start to notice some big differences. It's orbiting a star we call an M dwarf, an M-type star. It's about half the size of our sun, and it's about 2,000 degrees cooler than our own sun. It's emitting mostly red and infrared radiation as opposed to the yellow visible light that our own sun emits. As we're flying towards it, or if you can imagine that, we won't see it as being this really deep red star. We might see it as being kind of a orangish yellow hue just because of the response of our eyeball and how that's evolved on our own Earth. These M-type stars have thick, deep convection zones in their upper layers that create intense magnetic fields. And those magnetic fields are what give rise to the sunspots and prominences and coronal mass ejections that we're familiar with on our own sun. But here you've got it exaggerated, you know, tenfold.
So standing on the surface, if I got that far, I'd see the sun performing a light show virtually every day.
Yeah, you would. If the planet itself has magnetic fields like our own Earth does, then the wind of charged particles that's coming out of these coronal mass ejections are going to slam into the planet but be funneled by the magnetic fields towards the poles. And when these charged particles get funneled, they start colliding with the atmosphere. And that creates emission that we know as the northern lights, the northern and southern lights, or the aurorae.
So we would vote for rotation. That's something that we would want if we're going to be homesteading up there.
That's exactly right. You want rotation. It generates that magnetic field. But unfortunately, that's not what you might get. Well, what we know is that all life is carbon-based, and carbon-based chemistry requires water for its survival. So we're looking for planets where water can pool on the surface. Now, if you've got a central star where, you know, with such a low luminosity, only 4% that of the sun's luminosity, you're going to have to cozy up really close to that star in order to create those conditions, right, for liquid water. Well, if you cozy up next to the star, you're also going to experience very large tidal forces. And those tidal forces can lock us in to a synchronous rotation. And so Kepler 438b might be presenting only one of its faces towards the central star at all times.
All right. So I can't live on the dark side. I can't live on the light side. Could we find a place at the Terminator or whatever it is, that area where it's always in twilight, that's sort of half light and half dark?
You know, the Earth is, imagine like a rotisserie chicken. You know, the Earth is spinning on its axis and it gets nicely toasted on all sides. If you've got a planet that's locked in a synchronous rotation, then that rotisserie chicken is only getting burnt on one side, right? But it's not quite so dire. So Kepler 438b has an atmosphere, right? And so that atmosphere can be heated on one side, but then it's free to circulate through these extreme temperature gradients to the other side. So you could end up with a more temperate situation where the atmosphere is redistributing that heat from the day side over to the night side, making it more amenable to life.
What kind of atmosphere would you need, and how thick of an atmosphere would you need to make this convection effect so that you'd have warmth even on the dark side?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think even with an Earth-like atmosphere, you can manage that. It's probably not the case that it was always in this synchronous rotation. So the question on my mind would be, how long has it been that way? I would think that with time, this kind of dramatic weather, just like in a convection oven where you're circulating air, you're going to set up tremendous circulation patterns, you know, global circulation or convection cells that are going to create tremendous winds and the like. You might imagine initially you heat up the surface at that substellar point dramatically, and if there were oceans there, you might evaporate them, a large quantity of water, and that's going to create huge, thick clouds above that substellar point. Those clouds would actually work to cool the surface, which is kind of counterintuitive, right? Blocking the solar or the stellar radiation. And so that would operate for a while. You'd be kind of okay for a while. But then they would continue to heat and you would start getting that circulation. You'd push that warm air over to the backside. And then what's going to happen? It's going to condense. It's going to rain out, maybe even freeze. And so with time, slowly but surely, what I imagine might happen is that the oceans on the day side would gradually evaporate away and you would start piling up all of that water in a frozen state on the backside. And so now you're in a situation where that terminator that you mentioned before might be the ideal place to live, where you're kind of in between those two states.
438B, home sweet home, would it be for me, or a difficult environment where I'd have to be a tough old bird to survive?
For us, if we were to go and just be dropped in, airlifted into Kepler 438b, we'd have a hard time. But you know, life is prolific and robust and creative, and I could imagine that there would be life there on that planet that is adapted just fine.
A tour of 438b. Natalie Battaglia is Kepler mission scientist and a research astronomer at the NASA Ames Research Center. Natalie, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Hey, this is Ami from Hollywood, and I would not go simply because I have everything I need right here on Earth.
To the sounds of live band Red Barat, call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE to tell us your space dreams. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. The scale of World War II has meant that decades later, pieces of the war are still emerging. Families who said goodbye to loved ones, soldiers and pilots, never to see them again, are still hoping and occasionally finding remains and artifacts from the battlefield. On April 10, 1944, a B-24D Liberator carrying 12 U.S. crew members took off from an airfield in New Guinea. The flight was shot down soon after and all were lost. Remains of 9 of the men were never found until now. Their remains are coming home to be returned to their families, and one is being buried today at Arlington National Cemetery. Joining us now is Will Hilton, author of Vanished, the 60-year search for the missing men of World War II. Will, welcome.
Thank you.
What is the significance of this search and the quiet ways in which these remains return home?
You know, I think it's difficult for outsiders, for most of us, to understand the grief that continues to haunt these families of the missing. You know, of course, each of these families suffers a unique tragedy in the sense that the loss of any individual soldier is as specific as the person himself. But there are certain common issues for MIA families that have to do not just with the absence of the person, but with the uncertainty that accompanies an MIA death. When there's no body to bury, there's no official cause of death, and no sort of explanation of exactly what happened, it's very hard to process or accept. And in a lot of cases, you find among these MIA families, even as far back as World War II, that they've spent these decades holding on to the possibility that the person may be alive, or they may have spent a few decades suspecting that or wondering that or hoping that. And so the grief process takes on a distinct character.
And this history of the unfinished business goes really all the way back to the Civil War, which was a chaotic conflict in which so many were missing. In this particular case, this really tells the story of the nature of the battlefield in the Pacific Theater. Describe why so many people were missing in the Pacific Theater during World War II.
Well, so the water was a big factor. I have this old globe that I keep on my desk, and once in a while I'll roll it around its axis, and it's interesting that you can get a globe to a point where almost all you see is the Pacific. So, I mean, it's almost half of the planet. And in fact, it's larger than all of the land mass in the world put together. So when you're flying these missions across hundreds and sometimes more than 1,000 miles one way from one American-held airbase in 1944 to another, you know, to a Japanese target base. If anything goes wrong, the plane just disappears. I mean, if other people in the formation might see it go down, but the chances of having any kind of certainty as to whether there was a survivor are very slim. These threads of hope can really linger precisely because it's the water and because you can't see the wreckage of the plane, but you can imagine a scenario in which somebody on a raft made it.
Well, with that in mind, this reunion today is miraculous.
It really is. And, you know, I think it's important for us to remember specifically in this case, we're talking about World War II, which as a culture, we really celebrate this generation, you know, and for good reason. I mean, they brought us out of the Great Depression. Of course, they got us through the Second World War and into this period of unprecedented growth and stability. But in the process of celebrating what they did, I think we often lose sight of how much they lost in doing so, how much they sacrificed and suffered. And this is a generation that was really eviscerated. I mean, they were cut down in their prime, and the men were deeply traumatized on battlefields. You can find in writers like Sledge and Leckie a sense of just what they went through. Many of the vets don't like to talk about it.
Will Hilton is author of Vanished, the 60-year search for the missing men of World War II. Thanks so much, Will.
Thank you.
Millions of internet users are drawing their own conclusions after viewing footage posted online captured by people who witnessed a fatal encounter with police and a homeless man last night in a poor neighborhood of downtown L.A. Meanwhile, police in Los Angeles are conducting their own investigation into the fatal incident.
Anytime we have an officer-involved shooting and there's a loss of life, people are upset, and justifiably so. Nobody out there, no police officer out there, wants to be involved in a situation like this.
That's Los Angeles Police Department Commander Andrew Smith speaking about the investigation to KABC Television in L.A. Frank Stoltz is crime reporter for KPCC, Southern California Public Radio. He joins us from downtown L.A. Frank, what is the race issue that emerges out of this, if any, or is it just question marks at this point?
Lots of question marks. You call this a poor area of Los Angeles. It's probably the poorest area of Los Angeles and maybe of the entire state. Skid Row, on the eastern part of downtown L.A., is home to hundreds and hundreds of homeless people, folks who are in very low-income housing. There are a lot of drug addicts, a lot of mentally ill folks, and it's just a tough, tough area. And in this video, for those who may not have seen it, and as you say, has been seen 6 million times, there's a chaotic scene, this African-American man fighting with at least 5 LAPD officers. They wrestle him to the ground. You hear a taser for about 4 seconds. And then 5 gunshots. The LAPD says he tried to grab an officer's gun, and that's why the officers fired. But this comes in the context of ongoing tensions in this area between police and the population there.
Frank, has the LAPD identified all of the officers that were seen on video around that man on the ground?
No, not yet. But typically it does. Unlike a lot of police departments, the LAPD will identify initially often the officers involved in these kinds of incidents. They have not yet. Often they're worried about, at least they say, retaliation if they reveal officers' identities.
Are there reactions among citizens, neighbors, people in the Skid Row area?
Well, folks on Skid Row say this is more harassment. The harassment they talk about comes more in the form of ticketing people for low-level crimes like jaywalking, not so much these dramatic shootings. You know, these tickets that then go to warrant because they don't have the money to pay for the ticket, and then they can't get housing, and it's just a spiral of problems for them. But there is a lot of frustration about this particular incident. People are on edge in the Skid Row area, again, probably because it was caught on video.
Long history there in L.A. from the Rodney King case of events like this being caught on video. But, of course, today there's such a huge proliferation of cameras. And in the early going, the images we've seen are from bystander cameras. But we expect to learn something at some point from police body cam video. Is there any sense that all of this video will help us to understand what happened or increase the sense of nobody knows?
Well, it's interesting. Police have said that, one of the officers involved was wearing a body camera. So they have that video as well. And the mayor here, Mayor Eric Garcetti, has ordered all officers to start wearing body cams. I believe it's in within the next year or two. So L.A. is on track to have body cams. You know, you mentioned Rodney King, and, you kind of started with the racial question. There are plenty of folks who are saying it's no coincidence that this was an African-American man, you know, that if it had been a white person in Brentwood or in Beverly Hills, it wouldn't have gone down this way. You know, that's what civil rights, some civil rights activists are saying. Again, the police version is that, he tried to grab an officer's gun.
And we don't know the name of the specific shooter here, and five gunshots could be five shooters, right?
They say there were three officers who fired their weapons, and that's all they're saying at this point.
Frank Stoltz, crime reporter for KPCC, Southern California Public Radio. Thanks, Frank.
Thank you for your time.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com. Brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide. With personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
Far underneath the record snows in the state of Maine this year, the potential riches of gold and copper has people arguing about some old issues, mining rights and environmental worries. J.D. Irving, an oil and forestry company, and others have their eyes on metal deposits in the rocks of Bald Mountain in the northwestern part of the state. An estimated 33.8 million tons of ore lies beneath Bald Mountain. But before the big machines can start digging, the state will have to update its mining laws from back in 1991. Joining me now is Mal Leary, chief political correspondent for Maine Public Broadcasting. Welcome, Mal.
Thank you very much, John.
So what is the process at this point? Where are we in this process before we talk about what's actually under Bald Mountain and some of these other deposits?
Well, what we have is a request that went from the legislature initially to the Department of Environmental Protection to create rules to allow large-scale mining in Maine. And that has digressed into a political battle where the Republican-controlled legislature did one thing, a Democratic-controlled legislature did another, and currently we have split control. The Republicans control the Senate, the Democrats control the House. So we're on like the third round in 3 years of coming up with rules for mining, and this legislation will likely end up splitting the committee down party lines.
And what's the resource that's out there, gold and some other metals?
Several kinds of metals. Gold, of course, is the one that most folks are after. It's in some ore deposits that have been pretty well researched in Aroostook County. That's in northern Maine. Mining inherently means digging in the ground, using explosives to blast the ore so that it can be then processed. The chemical process is what's got a lot of the environmentalists concerned because the ore that's in this area has a real toxic mix of stuff that's being developed in order to mine the underlying metals.
Well, here's Nick Bennett, staff scientist for the Natural Resources Council of Maine, at a public hearing on that Bald Mountain site in Augusta on the 25th.
That site's an extremely dangerous site. Very high levels of sulfur, very high levels of arsenic. That sulfur, when it's dug up and exposed to air and water, forms sulfuric acid. The sulfuric acid leaches the arsenic out of the rocks. So that site is really unlikely to be a safe place to mine, whatever the rules are.
Now, Mainers who listen to that audio of Nick Bennett, probably if you live in the northern part of the state, the first question you ask is, yeah, where does he live? Probably somewhere down in the south of the state, right? Is the environmentalists associated with the high density part of the state and other people in the north are a completely different constituency?
Well, it is a completely different constituency, but a lot of folks drove all the way. It's a 4.5-5 hour drive from northern Maine down to the Capitol to testify, and a lot of folks drove down from Aroostook County. And the testimony was overwhelmingly opposed. Again, a lot of the testimony, John, was these rules won't work for this site. This particular site with this particular ore is too dangerous to even think about taking out of the ground, is the position of the environmentalists. We have a huge state geographically. We're as big as the rest of New England combined. So we've got a lot of unexplored territory in northern Maine where there may be other mineral deposits, metallic mineral deposits, that can be mined in the future. So folks were arguing, let's try to come up with rules that work in places where we can successfully take this stuff out of the ground and stop worrying about what the J.D. Irving Company, those are the folks from Canada that own the Bald Mountain area, are trying to propose, because we just don't think it can work.
Well, that's the other issue that you raise here. The Irving folks really turn this into a kind of a Chinatown story of the industry versus the citizens. And let's get a feel for the passions that are raised once you raise the name of some of these companies that are at stake here. Here's environmentalist Brownie Carson of Harpswell in an exchange with Republican Senator Tom Saviello.
Is Irving going to do to Maine? And I don't mean to dump on Irving here, but Brownie, is Irving going to do to Maine what other companies... Are they going to do to Maine what other companies have done
You're
to
done.
Other states, Senator Saviello?
Sit down. I don't want any attack of individuals in here or companies. It already started in here. I'm not going to deal with it now, so thank you very much.
Well, we all know what they're up to, Tom.
Thank you very much.
Do people believe that legislators are in the pockets of Irving? And what's Irving say about all this?
Well, certainly some people believe that some of the lawmakers are in the pockets of Irving. That's been a long-running issue. It's very hard to get the Irvings to talk about much of anything that they do. And they are a very important part of the economy in the northern part of the state. Not only do they own an awful lot of land, they're the largest single landowner in northern Maine, but they own a lot of forest-related industries. They even have a lot of gas stations all across northern and eastern Maine that they supply from their refinery in St. John, New Brunswick. So they're very important to the northern part of the state's economy, much more so than southern Maine.
Now, is Irving the one that would do the mining here, or would they basically benefit from licensing and leasing the land?
Well, they actually set up a company to do it, a wholly owned subsidiary that would do the actual mining. And part of the issue here is how many jobs would this mining actually create? Opponents were saying that the average life of one of these metallic mines is 7 to 10 years. So do you want to trade all the problems that will come about of mitigating a site 10 years from now for the few jobs, relatively speaking, that would be created over that 7 or 10 year period? So there's a lot of those economic arguments are going on, and those are compelling in northern Maine. I mean, northern part of our state is doing not very well compared to the southern part of the state. Southern part of the state, we're talking, I believe the economists would say, full employment, you know, 3% unemployment. You've got high single digits, low double digits in northern Maine.
And when would this all come to a head politically, or is it going to be a stalemate?
Well, I think it's going to end up being a stalemate, actually, in terms of the politics of all of this, because the committee's pretty well split. So whatever you come out with rules, it's going to be a divided report going to the full legislature. And it is most likely going to end up that this is going to be one of those political battles that continues well beyond this session of the legislature.
One last question for you there, Mal. Are they sure that Bald Mountain is still there under all that snow?
John, we've had so much snow. It has been amazing here in Maine. At the end of my driveway, I once had a 9-foot pile that we had to bring in a front loader to clean out.
And that's a whole other story. Mal Leary, chief political correspondent for Maine Public Radio. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, providing solutions for business owners, families, and individuals to get legal help, including incorporation, LLCs, wills, and living trusts. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com. And Box Searchlight Pictures, presenting the second best exotic Marigold Hotel. The new comedy directed by John Madden, starring Judi Dench, Maggie Smith, Bill Nye, Dev Patel, and Richard Gere, in theaters everywhere Friday.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
All right, so let's have some real fun here. We're going to spend time with today's live band. I mean, why not? We got a live band, right? Red Barat, besides doing the Takeaway gig, which is prestigious enough. They've played Bonnaroo, Austin City Limits, the Monterey Jazz Festival. They've played this little D.C. venue on 16th Street and Pennsylvania Avenue. I guess it's a White House. Oh, geez, it's the White House. You've done the White House.
We have, yeah.
Shugie G is their last album. It debuted at number one on the Billboard World Music Charts. They've been touring to roll out their new album, Gaudy of Truth. That's where this tune is from. Gaudy's kind of like a journey, right?
Yeah, Gaudy in Hindi like actually means train or automobile, but this title, Gaudy of Truth, is like a metaphor for the journey.
It's more than a metaphor. I mean, I'm kind of rocking back and forth when I hear this music, that sort of thing. Now, you're playing the Dol, right?
The Dol, yep.
The Dol. Okay, mm-hmm. that drum is a strange-looking, wonderful-looking drum. You kind of have to have a band. You can't sort of wander around New York playing that thing by yourself, right?
You could.
You could.
But it's so much better with this band.
You know, we have something in common. Uh-huh. We were both raised in Rochester, New York.
You know, I was going to ask you if you were, because I noticed you're from upstate. We have
another thing
in common.
That's right. What else?
Twins.
Twins!
I only have one set, though.
One set of twins. Yeah. All right, so Sonny Jane, founder and lead Dol player of Red Barat. I have two sets of twins.
Yes.
I got you beat. But Rochester, New York, what a strange place to grow up. I mean, was your dad an engineer at Kodak?
He was a research scientist, crystallographer at the University of Rochester.
There you go.
Came from India for that, and I was born and raised in Rochester, in Henrietta.
Were you supposed to go to, like, the Eastman School of Music?
No, I quickly left as soon as I was 18. I just I went to Rutgers in New Jersey and studied jazz performance over there.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So where does Red Barat fit into the sort of genre scene? Are you Bhangra? Are you klezmer? Are you what are you? I see a sousaphone, a trombone, a trumpet, a soprano sax, a Stratocaster-y looking thing, and at least three rhythm sections here, including you.
Yeah. You know, it's a good question. It's an amalgamation of a lot of different things. At its root, it's Punjabi music. It's Indian brass band tradition. But there's a little bit of everything coming in. There's jazz, there's go-go, there's funk. I mean, it sounds a little absurd to just kind of talk about it and throw out a bunch of genre names. But as, you know, the listeners heard, it's really unique kind of sound.
What about Britney Spears? Any Britney Spears?
I mean, you know,
No.
Hafner throws a little Britney in there every now and
then. So you're touring as part of a festival here that's actually a traditional festival. It's celebrated all over the world, but people who know South Asia and know India know it as that festival where they put the colored dust all over each other and jump in the river at Benares or wherever. Tell me a little bit about this.
Yeah, the festival is called Holi, and also known as Festival of Colors. And this is our fourth annual Festival of Colors. We're bringing it to D.C., Boston, and we're doing two shows in New York. We're doing one at the Bowery Ballroom on Saturday. We're doing Brooklyn Bowl on Sunday. We're going to be joined by a couple different artists, Brooklyn Raga Massive All-Stars and also Rupa and the April Fishes. But we're also screening a film called Radhe Radhe, which is known as The Rites of Holi. It's something that Vijay Iyer and director film maker Prashant Bhargava had made last year. And it's a 35-minute depiction of a city in India called Mathura, where the Holi festival is actually occurring, and you can see all the fervor that's happening in there with the colored powder and whatnot, and the ecstaticness of the joy of the festival. So it's beautiful. Yeah, we're going to be able to bring it fourth time this year.
Great. So ecstaticness. Was there a lot of ecstaticness at the White House when you played there?
I think there was a lot of interestingness. You know,
it was
a White House.
It was boring.
So, I mean, you know
so
what?
You want ecstaticness, forget the White House. You got to play Narendra Modi's, one of his events,
there
right?
There we go. There we go.
Are you a fan of Modi? Are you a little, like, kind of, I don't know?
John.
Yeah.
Not a huge fan. No, I'm not a huge fan.
All right. Well, you might still get at one of his gigs. He's got serious Twitter. Twitter heat.
He does, yeah.
That's for sure. Do you think this is a good time for South Asia, India, Pakistan? Is this a troubled time? What do you think? Your music certainly brings a message of put it all together.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's always a troubled time and always a good time. Things are always kind of moving and shifting and in a pendulum. For us right now, you know, as a band and as a few of us from the South Asian diaspora, it feels like a good time, but there's a lot of trouble in the air with things that happen in Ferguson or things that happen right here at home, you know,
LA,
with Eric Garner, and that impacts not even people of color, but impacts all of us. And so I think that's something that we all have to take a look at.
You know, Peter Gabriel's a pal of yours, right, has asked you to play with him. And certainly a generation ago, there was talk that Gabriel was kind of an anthropologist of going around and sampling music from around the world. It's changed a lot. This is much more sort of mainstream, wouldn't you say?
This music, Red Barat?
Yeah, I mean, I just think your music and the various kind of world musics, they're much more sort of in the mix now.
They are, you know, I mean, there's still that genrefying of what world music is, you know, and people define it in different ways when it's really, most of the time, it's just music indigenous to certain people's culture, you know.
Right.
But this band, I think, is bringing various cultures and various music from different cultures together. I don't want to necessarily say it's the epitome of world music or anything.
No, genre
in general and that term is a little bit reductive. But it is definitely a different time in terms of what we're doing where we're not using a bunch of production samples and everything. We're really just playing instruments, brass and horns and drums.
I mean, like all musicians, you hate genres, the whole genre talk. It's like,
we do.
Cut that out. Put that aside. Let's hear. Take us out?
Yeah.
Take us out. What are you going to play? What do you got?
We're going to
play. I heard you deciding before. It was very exciting listening.
Yeah. We're going to play an original that's on our latest album called Gaudy of Truth, which we're touring around this month all over the world. And it's an original by our percussionist, Rohin, and it's called Horizon Line.
And while you go over to the microphone, I'm going to start us up. And then I'm going to get fired. They're going to fire me. All right, guys. Take it away.
Thanks so much to Red Barat. Check out thetakeaway.org for more, lots more. Give us your take at 877-8MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Follow me on Twitter. I'm at Jay Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country. ShopKeep, a POS analytics and management system that works to help people grow their businesses. More information at ShopKeep.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.